Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the big story in the news, and that is the economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C. We'll begin with an analysis of dueling speeches at the 11th hour, the president's and John Boehner's, that were afforded equal time in the press, even though only one side is threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of what they want. Jonathan Cohn, the senior editor at The New Republic, joins us to discuss who is really responsible for the deficit and the debt. Then we will talk to a presidential historian who studies both the American right and the presidency, Alan Lichtman, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement. He joins us to assess the role of the Tea Party in preventing compromise as the American ship of state heads for the abyss. Then, in light of criticism from James Carville and others who faced a similar situation during the Clinton administration when Newt Gingrich threatened to shut down the government, which he did, we will talk strategy, which according to many is sorely lacking in the Obama White House. Carl Agnew, a campaign strategist, joins us to explain whether Obama's latest speech is too little too late and what moves might be left for him before the economy is destroyed and his election chances end up as collateral damage. Joining us now is Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior editor at The New Republic and a senior fellow at Demos. Previously, he was the executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohn.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What was your impression of the president's address to the nation, followed by John Boehner's address? My feeling about it, frankly, Jonathan, is I've never seen it before. The press in this country were kind of billing them as with equal time.
Yeah, it's unusual. We've gotten into the habit of, it's custom now when there's a major address to Congress, for example. You know, the president gives the State of the Union, then there's a response from the Republican or Democratic opposition, depending on who's in the White House. I don't recall them doing this for this was a much smaller scale speech. It was impromptu, and this is a new development, I think. I'm not 100% sure about that. I don't really mind it, by the way. I'm always, I'm a journalist, so more speech is better, and, let's air out both sides. But it did seem like something new.
The president is the president, and he's able to do this. He has that prerogative. But let's talk about then the speeches themselves. We're not going to review them, but I'd like to get your impression of who made the stronger case.
Well, it's funny. I always sort of try to remind myself when I'm watching a speech like this one that, 99% of the country has a life, and that life does not, that does not involve following politics for a living. So as a professional watching these speeches, I'm hearing things often for the 10th, the 100th time, and so I always try to put myself in the mind of someone who really hasn't followed this debate but is really hearing it for the first time. They've heard some rumbling. There's some fight about debt level and deficit. What's this all about? Oh, okay, the president is going to speak. The leader of the Republican Party is going to speak. What did I hear? I thought they actually got a fairly accurate portrayal in some ways of the two positions, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the president has agreed that as part of this agreement to raise the debt ceiling, which is something we need to do. Remember, this is not about spending new money. It's about paying the bills that we ran up before. That as part of this agreement to raise that debt ceiling, he's willing to make an agreement with the Republican Party on how to reduce deficits in the long run. And in so doing, he's willing to meet them. He's described himself meeting them halfway, a little more than halfway. I would say he's gone well beyond meeting them halfway. I think most people who watch this from have noticed, and not just liberals, but even conservatives, said, gee, the deals to which he has agreed to and which, frankly, a good number of Republicans in the Senate have agreed to involve giving up a lot more from the Democratic side than they do from the Republican side. And by that we mean, and there's been agreements to reduce a lot of spending, not just on what we call discretionary programs, student loans, funding for the FAA, things like that, but, mandatory entitlement spending, passing some cuts to Medicaid and Medicare, things that I really am not very happy about. And the Republicans, in turn, have not given a lot, despite, I think, fair evidence that, we could return tax rates to what they were during the Clinton era. The Republicans have said no to any revenue at all in the deal. And he's made clear that he's tried to compromise, but the problem is these House Republicans who won't compromise. And then we had the leader of the House Republicans, Speaker Boehner, get up there and say, we're not going to compromise, basically saying the same thing, that we have a hard line on this. We will not agree to this if we have to put serious new revenue on the table, and that's it. And I think it's, well, that's pretty much, you understand those two facts, that we have one side that's willing to compromise, one side that is making a very hard stand on this principle of no revenue, and you have a pretty good understanding of why we're in this situation now.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, I know we live in an era, the post-Karl Rove era, where the truth is a moving target, and he who manages and manipulates the truth the most effectively wins the argument. And there's no consensus anymore in this country about what is true. To that extent, I think we're disadvantaged. But it would seem to me that the one thing that might resonate, and I think there's a lot of polling to suggest that, is that the president made it real clear that the Republicans are absolutely fighting to the last man to protect the prerogatives of the millionaires and the billionaires. And he made that point over and over again. Boehner looked to me like he was angry and didn't want to have to even bring that subject up, because I think to some extent the president is shaming them, indicating how faithful they are to their billionaire backers. And it would seem to me that that might resonate. And I know the Republicans have come up with this wonderful piece of mental gymnastic now to refer to millionaires and billionaires as job creators. But I don't think that's washing.
No, I don't think it is either. And when you think about the politics of this, and you know, who knows? I always sort of give a disclaimer. I feel very comfortable saying for sure what I think about policy. Politics, you know, who knows? It's changing. People see things differently. But the polls certainly indicate that if you ask people in this country, right, if you go out and say, look, we have these deficits, we need to close them, how should we close them? And most Americans, they want a mix of things. And as part of that mix, they think, yeah, let's ask the very wealthiest members of this country to pay a little more in taxes than they do now, particularly given the fact that they've done so well, particularly recently, and that ever since 2001, when President Bush came into office, their taxes have gone down. And most Americans like this. Again, when we go back to the deals that were offered, all that, you know, the deals that President Obama offered recently, the only thing he was asking was, look, let's get some revenue back from the wealthiest Americans. And this the Republicans will not do. I mean, they have indicated clearly over and over again this is a bright red line for them. They do not want those tax rates to go up on. They think it's wrong. Now, they call it job killers, and some of them do argue that, well, if you raise taxes on the very wealthiest people in this country, you know, that's not going to work. It's going to kill jobs because these are the wealth creators. You know, the two things to remember when you hear that are, number one, nobody is talking about raising taxes in the next year or year and a half. I mean, we are in a very precarious economic situation right now. We don't have enough jobs. Frankly, I think that's what we should be spending all our time talking about and putting, not really worrying so much about the deficit right now. We do have this jobs problem, and because of that, everybody seriously who's talking about either cutting government spending or raising taxes, both of which would slow economic growth, they talk about doing it starting in a year or two once the economy is on a surer footing. So that's the first thing. No one's talking about raising taxes tomorrow. But the second thing to remember is that, you know, we have experience with higher tax rates on the wealthy, and it's called the 1990s. And guess what? The economy grew pretty well back then. And in fact, there's a lot of literature on this. I mean, there is a point at which you can raise taxes enough that you could really start to kill jobs. We are pretty far away from that right now. You know, compared to other countries, we have a ridiculously low tax burden in this country. We can afford to raise taxes on the wealthiest members of our society without harming the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's the senior editor at The New Republic. Just in terms, though, of this environment where the truth is a moving target, you've published this graph that I think came from the New York Times, and it was based on figures from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, and it really makes it clear. It's called the Bush deficit. It just shows you there in black and white and red the difference between what Obama has run up in terms of debt and what his predecessor, George W. Bush, ran up in terms of debt. And my understanding, just in broad strokes, is that George W. Bush has actually run up over a third of the entire national debt since the beginning of the Republic. And if you combine him with his father and Ronald Reagan, that accounts for over half of the entire debt since the beginning of the Republic.
Well, I don't know about those precise figures, but certainly it is the case that when you think about the deficits we have right now, and you think about whose responsibility are they, again, if you listen to the commentary out there, if you listen to the Republican Party, if you listen to the conservative commenters, they'll say, President Obama has run up the deficit. But that's not really true. To the extent that the policies of the Obama administration have contributed to the deficit, it is largely because of very temporary spending measures enacted during the economic slowdown for good reason. You know, when the economy is slow, we want deficit spending. That's how we boost demand. I mean, this is economics 101. Anyone who sort of believes in sort of the basic mainstream principles of economics would agree to that, conservatives too. The real drivers of the debt right now turn out to be the fact that, well, gosh, what happened during the Bush years? First thing they did, they cut taxes substantially. And then, you know, they had two wars that they didn't bother to pay for, and they enacted a drug benefit for Medicare that they didn't pay for. And again, the contrast here is, I think, quite stunning, whether you want to go back in time or forward in time. And by that, I mean, let's look at what the Bush administration did on its Medicare drug benefit, and let's compare that approach to what President Obama did with health care reform. You know, one of the reasons that health care reform fight took so long and was so painful was that President Obama and his allies in the Democratic Congress were determined to pass a health care bill that actually paid for itself. That's very hard to do. You had to raise some they had to levy some taxes to go with it. You had to cut some spending to go with it, and they did it. Unlike the Bush administration, which said, oh, we're just going to, you know, have this new benefit and we're not going to bother to pay for it. That contributed to deficits. If you go back in time, remember again, during the 1990s, President Clinton, and before him, by the way, the first President Bush, who was a lot more responsible about these things, they signed off on budgets that actually reduced deficits by a combination of higher taxes and lower spendings. And lo and behold, we got to the end of the 1990s, and because of those changes and because of a strong economy, not only was had we eliminated the deficit, people forget now, but the government was running surpluses. And, you know, in the 2000 presidential debate, there was a big debate about what to do with these surpluses. And the Democrat who was running for president, Al Gore, said, well, let's put those aside for a rainy day, because you know what? We have surpluses now, but we won't in the future. And George Bush said, no, we can't have surpluses. The government will just spend the money. We need to give that all back as tax cuts. Well, those tax cuts created a huge budgetary hole that are a big reason for our deficits right now. Frankly, if we got rid of all the Bush tax cuts, and to be fair, we'd have to get rid of the ones that benefit lower incomes as well, we'd really take care of the deficit problem, at least for the next few years. There's a long-term problem that would require other changes, but don't for a second believe anybody who tells you that these are Obama's deficits right now. They're not. They're Bush's deficits.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohen, who's a senior editor at The New Republic. And I think, though, when you mentioned George H.W. Bush, W.'s father, how he was responsible, I think he was more than responsible. He was actually quite courageous in that he did what leaders are supposed to do and what Obama's actually been calling upon the Republicans to show some signs of leadership. Remember, he violated his no new tax pledge, and that cost him dearly politically, but he did the right thing.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it's a reminder of the kind of leadership to which we were once accustomed, right, in this country from both parties. And you know, and there was a time when you had plenty of people in the Republican Party who thought like he did. It was controversial at the time, but it was not crazy that a Republican would say, gee, we might have to raise taxes. After all, Ronald Reagan himself raised taxes during his administration. It was understood that if you're going to be a responsible leader, if you're going to be a reasonable steward of the public trust, that sometimes you're going to have to compromise, and sometimes you're going to have to do things that maybe you don't want to do, but they're necessary, in this case, to keep the finances of the U.S. government on a sound footing.
Well, he raised...
Reagan
did raise a rather aggressive tax, which was the payroll tax, which in effect punishes people for having jobs.
Yes,
opposed to Bush's...
exaggerate the virtues of Ronald Reagan,
right,
here.
But I'm saying just compared to Bush's tax cuts, which disproportionately went to the wealthy. So let's just deal with in the last few minutes then, Jonathan Cohen. Again, I know you're comfortable with the economics, not the politics, but let's talk strategy then, because James Carville, who was a strategist for Clinton, and I think Clinton played things much better than it appears that Obama's playing things in terms of his face-off with Newt Gingrich when a similar situation happened. In this case, of course, the government was shut down. Now the stakes are much, much greater. You have an economic hostage crisis brought on by the Republicans for the first time in the history of the debt ceiling, and they are really threatening to bring the house down. And, of course, the problem that Obama has in calling their bluff is that he's going to be stuck with a devastated economy, which, by the way, is exactly what Donald Trump just said, rather with a glee on Fox News with Fox and Friends, saying, well, they'll forget about it in a year's time and the place will be such a mess that it'll all be on Obama's plate and it'll destroy his presidency. So Carville is saying that so far it's been a Republican rout, that this White House has been completely wrong-footed from day one. And a lot of the criticism is that the speech that Obama just made, he should have made it weeks ago.
Yeah, no, actually it was funny. Last night after the speech, I got emails from two different senior staff in Congress. And almost word for word, they said the same thing, which was great speech, would have been perfect a month ago. And I as reluctant as I generally am to second-guess people on strategy, because I tend to think I don't know all the moving pieces and I'm not really good at multidimensional chess, it really does seem like Obama has not handled this well. I mean, he's given concession after concession after concession, and, you know, we're no closer at this point to actually having a deal in place. That said, I don't know how this all plays out. I don't know who blames whom. I mean, if you look at the polls, the one thing that does seem to work to the administration's advantage is that people do trust the president a lot more on this than they do the Republicans. And I think a big part of their strategy is to portray Obama genuinely as he is, as a sort of responsible adult who's going to try to do what he thinks is right for the country. And I think that's what he's doing. I don't necessarily agree with him, but I do think that's his strategy. Now, the problem, as you mentioned, is that at the end of the day, if the Republicans end up maneuvering us into a place where they destroy the economy, you know, they may take the initial blame for this agreement blowing up, but Obama's the one running for re-election and needs a good economy to help him. And it's very dangerous. It's really difficult to know how this turns out and how this turns out. Well, although, I'll be honest, I think we're about to see a strange dance happen on Capitol Hill, and we'll see what happens. I don't think anybody exactly knows what's going to happen. It's unusual to have this kind of uncertainty.
It would seem, though, just in terms of tactics, that the president has boxed himself into these pretty difficult choices. You just pointed out that he's reaching out to the center and coming across as the sober adult in the room. And that's clearly what he's been positioning himself to be. But if he does compromise, which I think is fairly likely, he's going to really alienate the already peeved progressive base of the party. So to your mind, is it you're better off winning over the center and losing the left?
Well, I think he's better off not losing either one. And I'm not sure, you know, and he has to figure out a way to do that. Honestly, I don't think he can afford to lose either. I mean, there's not a lot of margin for error at this point. He loses his base. He needs that turnout for the re-election. He loses the center. He loses the swing votes. It may be possible to pull this off. You know, we haven't seen the final chapter yet, and it will be interesting to see what happens if, as I think I expect and a lot of other people expect, Speaker Boehner's plan doesn't pass the House. That will create an interesting dynamic. And, you know, there's an ending here that works reasonably well for the president and the Democrats. Whether it happens or not very much remains to be seen.
I thank you for joining us here today, Jonathan Cohn.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior editor at The New Republic and a senior fellow at Demos. Previously, he was the executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and The People Who Pay the Price. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a historian about the Tea Party and presidents.
What a ceiling! Mercantiling! Now sends every risk to the U.S. fisc, we learn. After trillions, are there zillions? Since we make no good.